This week, chaos reigns in Israel as we study 1 Kings 15:25 through 16:28. As you well know, it was only a few chapters prior that Israel split in two, with Judah in the south and Israel in the north. The northern kingdom was headed by Jeroboam. 2 weeks ago, we studied Jeroboam's death. Keeping things chronological as well as we can, we studied Asa, king of the southern kingdom of Judah, last week, since Asa had taken control of Judah just a few years before Jeroboam died in Israel. In the course of studying Asa, we noted that he had his fair share of conflict with the northern kingdom, because during his reign, the northern kingdom went through a period of upheaval. Last week, I had said that there were six kings in Israel during Asa's reign, but actually there were seven. First, Jeroboam, but then Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, and finally Ahab. Obviously, we aren't going to discuss Jeroboam today. We've covered him previously. We also aren't going to dig into Ahab just yet, since Ahab will survive for several chapters to come. The point, though, is that these were times of chaos in Israel. There were seven different kings within 40 years, and they weren't all even from the same dynasty. That is, this one, the son of that one, the son of that one. There were four different dynasties here, often with the new dynasty starting out by killing the old king and his entire family. And there was also at least one major clash with a well-backed rebel competing for the throne. To try and give this some comparison, just imagine that your state seceded from the United States and then plunged into civil war and genocide, with a different rebel faction forcefully setting up an entirely new government under a new state constitution once every 10 years on average, while fighting wars with external neighbors to boot. Then color all of that with masses of people worshiping false idols and living in flagrant sin. That's what life was like in Israel at the time. It was a mess. And all of that mess, of course, will lead us to a brief consideration of governmental legitimacy and why Israel's kings during the time period had none of it. Your passage for consideration is 1 Kings 15:25 through 16:28, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and read it now. Our sprint through five kings begins with Nadab. Nadab's reign was short and bitter. He was the son of Jeroboam, and that in itself should give us pause to consider his character. Jeroboam had been a particularly wicked king, and he passed his philosophy and lifestyle on to his son. Nadab was wicked just as Jeroboam had been, but it didn't last long. You will recall that Ahijah the prophet had delivered a prophecy against Jeroboam's house back in 1 Kings 14. The prophecy was that the entire house of Jeroboam would be cut off, that they would be killed and left exposed for the dogs and the birds to eat. And that's just what happened. Baasha rose up and killed Nadab and his entire household. A quick point here, we've mentioned before that Ahijah was a very common name. Baasha was the son of a man named Ahijah, but this is not the same Ahijah as Ahijah the prophet. The passage calls Baasha's father Ahijah of the house of Issachar, while calling Ahijah the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite. At the time when Baasha killed Nadab, Nadab had been laying siege to the Philistine city of Gibbethon. Gibbethon is not a city of much consequence. It was mentioned in the tribal allotments of Joshua, but other than that, it appears only in today's passage. The city was part of the border between the tribal allotments of Dan and Ephraim. So this tells us how far north Philistine territory extended at the time, well into Dan's allotment and even across it, in at least this one place. This also suggests to us that Judah never possessed the area of Dan's allotment that was by the seacoast. Apparently, Israel remained at war with the Philistines around Gibbethon for decades thereafter, since there was also a siege at Gibbethon at the time when Zimri was king. So that's the end of the short reign of Nadab. The author of 1 Kings cites as his source for his historical account the Book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, which, as we have mentioned before, is no longer extant. So Baasha killed the king. He killed all competitors to the throne, and thus he seized power by force, illegitimately declaring himself to be king. We note plainly that there is nothing legitimate about becoming king in this way, and it is not the way that we have ever seen anyone else in Israel becoming king. Previously, we've seen clear examples that Israel's legitimate leaders were chosen by God as expressed through the religious leadership and were confirmed by the people. So, for example, you could see Joshua, Saul, David, or Solomon. Even Jeroboam had that. Simply having the power to do what you want and to force others to do what you want does not make it morally right and acceptable for you to do so. It is not acceptable to just force people to do things because you feel like it, even if you are powerful enough to get away with it. It is only acceptable for you to force others to do what you want when you have God's authority to do so, and that authority is communicated through God's laws. So there's a big difference between ruling over people by force and being a legitimate king. We read in verse 33 that Baasha seized power in the third year of Asa's reign, and that he reigned for 24 years from Tirzah, the same city where Jeroboam had made his capital. This is the longest reign of any of these kings. As we would expect from a man who seized power in the way that he did, or as we should expect from any king of the northern kingdom of Israel, Baasha did evil in the sight of Jehovah. The passage reminds us that there was war between Baasha and Asa, king of Judah. We discussed that last week when we considered Asa's reign, so you can see that message for more on that. In summary, it didn't go well for Baasha, and he ended up abandoning land he seized from Judah to go and fight against Ben-Hadad of Aram. The evil deeds of Baasha did not go over well for him, and as happened to too many kings in this time period, he also got a visit from a prophet who was carrying a message of doom. This time, the prophet was Jehu, the son of Hanani. If Hanani sounds familiar, that's because we mentioned him last week. He had prophesied against Asa about this same time, and Asa had had him thrown into prison for it. So we've got a father-son prophetic team here. Whether the two were active at the same time, or whether Jehu started prophesying after his father was thrown into prison, is unclear. The prophecy against Baasha is very similar to the prophecy against Nadab, whom Baasha killed. There is a brief recounting of history, that God had lifted Baasha up and made him king, and then there is an indictment, that Baasha had led the people in all of the same sins that Jeroboam had, and then a punishment. Baasha's house would be swept away as Jeroboam's house had been, and everyone of his house would die and be deprived of a proper burial, left out to be eaten by the dogs or the birds. Interestingly, the passage says in 1 Kings 16:7 that Baasha was being punished not only because he had walked in the ways of Jeroboam, but also because he had destroyed Jeroboam's house. That is very interesting because the penalty against Jeroboam's house had been handed down by God himself through his prophet. The matter was foreordained before Baasha accomplished it, and it served God's good purpose, and yet, clearly, Baasha's actions in seizing the throne were immoral, and Baasha was rightly to be punished for them. It is clearly demonstrated in this passage, then, that God does foreordain events, even wicked events, and that the people who perform wicked actions bring about those foreordained events and are accountable for their actions, and that even those evil actions and events bring glory to God. Romans 9 encapsulates this doctrine well, as we have discussed before. And so Baasha died. The account of his reign was written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. He was buried in Tirzah, and his son Elah reigned in his place. And indeed, Baasha's end becomes eerily similar to that of Jeroboam. Both of them reigned for 20-some-odd years, then had a son who reigned for only a few years, and then his entire household was slaughtered by the new incoming king. In both cases, the new king had apparently been a member of the army of the old king. And that doesn't bode well at all for Elah. He reigned for only 2 years before one of his chariot commanders, Zimri, killed him. Elah had been drinking himself drunk, which is not a wise thing for anyone to do, but is especially unwise for a king to do, and he had dropped his defenses, enabling Zimri to walk right in and kill him. Predictably, Zimri crowned himself king and then went on to kill the entire house of Baasha, including all of his friends. This, of course, fulfilled the prophecy of Jehu, son of Hanani. Elah's works were recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, like the other kings before him. And then, in another unjustifiable seizure of power, Zimri, who killed Elah, became king after him. Zimri did not last long at all, being king for only 7 days. In fact, with a reign that short, it is hard to see how he could have even called himself king. It might have been more accurate to just say that he killed the king and then hung around in the king's house for a week until justice came for him. It would be nice to know a little more about who Zimri was, how he pulled off his plot to kill the king, and how he had claimed the throne and planned to secure it. Apparently, such information did exist in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, but alas, it is no longer extant, and that information is lost to us today. But justice did come for Zimri, and justice came in the form of Omri. Omri was the military commander at the time, and he was leading another siege at Gibbethon. When news reached the army that King Elah was dead, they crowned Omri king and went to kill Zimri. They set a siege against Tirzah, and Zimri, seeing the hopelessness of the situation, burned the palace down over his own head, committing suicide in the process. Lesson learned. If you want to be king, you'd better have either the support of the people or support of a military strong enough to hold them back. If you have no military and you have no support, you won't last long as king. Of course, Zimri's death was no great loss. For the week that he lived as king, he was just as evil as anyone else and served idols as Jeroboam had. Zimri's death did not wrap things up with a neat and tidy bow. 16:16 had told us that all Israel had made Omri king, but it is hard to see how such could have been possible less than a week after the king's death. Surely large portions of the population didn't even know that Elah was dead when Omri claimed the throne. Probably the verse should more precisely say that the military had crowned Omri king. And after Zimri died, there was significant dispute about that. A large portion of the population preferred Tibni, son of Ginath, to be king. And they wouldn't be settling this with a polite conversation or a vote, either. It came down to war between the supporters of Tibni and Omri, which concluded when Tibni died. Omri was not chosen by the people, he was just successful at eliminating his opposition. And so in the 31st year of Asa, he became king of Israel. And then, yet again, Omri was a bad king. Seemingly with every king of Israel, things just got worse, as we read here, yet again, that Omri did more evil than all who were before him. Other than that, the only memorable thing that Omri did was move the capital of Israel from Tirzah. No reason is given for the move. I might have supposed that after he had besieged Tirzah, the royal palace was burned down, and then Tirzah was no doubt rocked by civil war, such that it became a less than desirable place to serve as a capital. Omri decided to start fresh. 6 years into his reign, which for all we know is how long it took him to win his civil war, he built a new city. He went 10 miles west of Tirzah and purchased a hill from a man named Shemer for 2 talents of silver. If we have a correct measure for a talent, that's about 2,187.5 troy ounces, which today would be valued at about $58,000. Pretty cheap for enough land to build an entire city. In the modern U.S., that might get you about 5 acres of land, depending on where. Of course, cities were smaller at that time. He named the lot of land Samaria, after Shemer, who had formerly owned the hill, and then they began building there. Samaria would be Omri's capital, and it would remain the capital until the fall of Israel. The city would remain so prominent that even during the time of Christ, some 800 years later, the Romans would call the region thereabouts after the name of the city. Today, of course, the city is most famously associated with Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan. In application, I think we are compelled to look at the legitimacy of a ruler. We accept, based on passages like Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2, that modern Christians are to be subject to their rulers. But there are caveats to that. Those passages, for example, are explicit in saying that we are to be subject to those rulers inasmuch as they are subordinate to God and do good over evil. So if we are to apply the principles of such passages, we must apply some scrutiny to our leaders to know whether or not they are good or evil. And moreover, we must know to whom the passages refer. We can hardly be submissive to our rulers if we don't know who is or isn't a ruler. So what makes a ruler? What gives him his legitimacy? Well, today's passage doesn't so much tell us what makes a legitimate ruler as it shows us what doesn't make a ruler legitimate. And the lesson is this. Force alone does not give a ruler legitimacy. Most often the pattern of Israel during these wicked and unstable times was this. Kill anyone who gets in your way, and then you become king. But clearly these kings are not God-ordained. They are not backed by the people. They are not righteous. They don't do good. Look at the examples. Nadab was king because he was the son of Jeroboam, but he wasn't king long before Baasha killed him. Then Baasha was king, and when he died, his son became king, but not for long. Zimri killed him, and he became king. And then Omri besieged Zimri's city, leading to Zimri's death, and Omri became king. Many of the people supported Tibni to be king. Well, Omri killed him too, and thus he retained the throne. The pattern of Israel during this time period was that brute force alone was the only standard of governmental legitimacy. There's no morality, no definitive right or wrong in any of that. This is not law and order, it is the law of the jungle. This is might makes right, and the passage clearly does not describe this in a positive light. The result of this governing philosophy is that countless innocent people were killed. Chaos reigned. King after king did even more evil than anyone who came before him. Zimri literally burned the capital down. These men didn't rule with God's authority, nor with God's rules, nor with the consent of the people. The result was a kingdom which was racked with constant turmoil and doing only evil all the time. This is why Romans 13:5 warns us to be subject not only because of wrath, but rather because of conscience. We submit not because of force, but because of reason. And this is why Romans 13 warns us, not as the ESV wrongly translates, to be subject to governing authorities, but as the KJV says, to be subject to the higher powers. There is a line of authority that flows directly from God, who is the highest power, and those rulers who will not fall in line with that authority lack authority themselves. As mentioned previously, we've seen Israel's leaders anointed by the prophets, subject to the priests, reading from God's laws, and approved by the people. This is a picture to us of legitimate governance. In today's passage, Israel displays something different. Rule by brute force alone, and the result is evident. Under this kind of rule, Israel had lawlessness, wickedness, chaos, and death. It is a pattern of behavior which ultimately had them expelled from the Promised Land and sent away into exile, never to return. So then, as Christians, let us seek out legitimate government. Government backed by reason over wrath, that we may live showing honor to divine authority, so that we can live our best lives. To conclude then, this week we have studied 1 Kings 15:25 through 16:28. The passage tells how after the death of Jeroboam, Israel went through a period of great instability. While Judah had one king, Asa, Israel had seven: Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, and Ahab, of which we have studied the five in the middle. Some of these reigned not even a handful of years, and most of them came to the throne after a bloody coup in which they murdered the sitting king and all of his house. None of them were good kings, and Israel suffered evil times under their wicked leadership. These kings of kingdoms by force have been a common pattern throughout the history of the world, but the Bible offers us a different and a better model. Rulers approved by both God and the people who take their thrones peacefully and rule in accordance with God's laws.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.